get this straight. If the indictment is... if the indictment is, and I have seen you say this, that crossfire reduces everything, as I said in the intro, to left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right, left.
Stop.
Why do we have to fight?
Why do you argue?
We're in bad shape, fellas. We need help from the media, and they're hurting us. You're doing theater when you should be doing debate.
You're listening to Under Surveillance, WLEW's biweekly show on popular culture, politics, and the relationship between mass media and public opinion. I'm your host, Kevin Fulham, and every second and fourth Wednesday mornings, I'll be joined by a series of guests as we take a look at everything from the makeup of the Supreme Court to upcoming elections and to how social and political climates impact our view of the future in film and television. Under Surveillance is broadcast on WLEW, a listener-supported community radio. And for more information or to listen to archive shows, visit www.undersurveillance.org. Today on Under Surveillance, we'll be taking a second look at HBO's landmark crime drama, The Wire, which recently concluded its fifth and final season. Much of The Wire's action revolves around the Baltimore drug trade, but co-creators David Simon and Ed Burns use the show as a forum to tackle the subject of institutional dysfunction, ranging from city government to public education to the media. Returning as my guest is freelance writer Leonard Pierce, who is a film critic for Nerve.com, and whose work can be found at www.ludicid.com. The Wire, up next on Under Surveillance. Welcome to another edition of Under Surveillance on WLUW. My name is Kevin Fulham, and we'll be taking a final look at HBO's landmark crime drama, The Wire. And joining me today, as he did about a couple years ago when we first looked at the series, is freelance writer and pop culture critic Leonard Pierce. Welcome back, Leonard. Always a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you, Kevin. I'm always happy to be on.
Leonard is a film critic for Nerve.com, and he always has a slew of writing projects in progress. You can find out more information at his website at ludicid.com. That's ludicid.com. So for those of you who might not be that familiar with the show, The Wire is a drama that's set in Baltimore and primarily focuses on both the city's drug trade and also its law enforcement agencies. But the scope of the show has expanded throughout its run, and the program tackles problems facing a number of societal institutions, from education to politics to the media. It's been about a month since The Wire wrapped up its fifth and final season on HBO. Leonard, we originally talked about the show after its third season, and it was just starting to pick up a flood of critical acclaim. There was a great deal of uncertainty whether it would get renewed after that third year, but the fourth season was so well received that creator David Simon got the go-ahead to see his project through to the end. And now at this point, The Wire has garnered enough critical acclaim such that it doesn't really rank as quote-unquote the best show nobody's heard about anymore. Even Barack Obama called it his favorite TV show recently. And also new Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter held a public showing of a series finale at City Hall. But the program has never been that popular in terms of our audience numbers. And not just because it's a complex show, but it's a very distressing show to watch. The Wire seems to fly in the face of decades of TV history by presenting this landscape where the quote-unquote heroes of the show, the characters who try to take a stand against institutional failures, tend to get squashed time and time again. Leonard, has there been anything comparable in television that repeatedly leaves the viewer with this great sense of desperation almost?
I don't really think so. I mean, there have been moments of bleakness in television before, but never the sort of sustained note of hopelessness that The Wire delivers. And while it does allow us little moments of triumph and little moments of victory, David Simon, the man who co-created the show, has said many times that he really wants to resist that, not because he wants to depress everybody, but he says his goal in making The Wire is not to make people feel good and not to make them happy and give them nicely resolved endings, but to reflect the reality of urban environments and decaying institutions the way that he sees them. And he says that he doesn't accomplish that goal by giving us happy endings and people triumphing over the system. He says, if that's the sort of story you're looking for, there are 1,000 shows on television that will give it to you. So he does not deny that it's a show that's very bleak and very depressing in its tone, but he says that that's the way that he accomplishes the goal he set out to accomplish with the show.
Do you think that Simon sees American society as in the midst of this inexorable slide?
It's an interesting point, and one of the things that comes up time and again on the show is this notion that things are worse now than they have ever been. And I'm not sure that either Simon or Ed Burns, his co-creator, really believe that, because there are so many moments in the show where they sort of mock that idea. There's a very memorable moment, to my mind, I believe in season three, where Poot, one of the corner boys, the drug dealers of the streets, is being arrested by two of the cops, and the cops are complaining about how, you know, the kids on the corner now are so much more brutal than ever. And Poot really openly mocks that idea. It's like, every year I hear you guys come out and say, things are so much worse now than they ever were. And, you know, you kids today, you're just like monsters. And it's such a bitter scene, you know, in such a funny way that he's making fun of this idea, that I have to believe that Simon and Burns don't really buy into it. But I do believe that they think that institutions are sort of set up to achieve a certain level of incompetence and then sustain themselves. The point that he makes time and time again in the show is that institutions try to preserve the status quo. They're set up in such a way that reform is squashed, not because things are getting worse now than they ever were, but just because they're systems that are built to keep themselves running and to resist change, and that's the way it tends to go in any kind of big institutional situation. So I don't really believe that he thinks that things are so much worse now than ever, but I do think he believes that as long as these institutions are not severely pressured by some outside force to make change, then they're going to keep maintaining their status quo, which tends towards incompetence and failure. And, you know, there's just never seems to be enough pressure on them to make them change in a positive way.
Do you think that Simon is interested in enacting social change? I mean, he portrays, obviously, these institutional failures, whether it's the police, whether it's politics, whether it's the educational system of inner cities. If he's interested in enacting social change, it seems that, you know, why would he consistently portray the proponents of such change as being hopelessly doomed?
I think it's probably because he's got the combating motivations of both being a realist and a reformer at the same time. I think he certainly wants these institutions to change. And it's clear to me from interviews that he's given, and even, you know, he's one of those people who tends to stalk message boards about his own shows. I've seen a number of postings by him on Wire devoted message boards. And he's clearly a social liberal. You know, he's lashed out before at people who have made really conservative critiques against the show or interpretations of the show. But I also think he's a very cynical person. I think he's seen a lot of attempts at reform fail, and he certainly incorporates that into the storytelling of the show. You know, it's clear from watching the show that he believes there are certain social prescriptions that should be undertaken. I don't think there's any question after watching the third and fourth season that he believes that at least some level of drug legalization would be a positive step for the inner cities. But as to whether he really thinks those things are going to happen and whether they'll, whether they have a chance of being allowed to work, I think he's probably pretty cynical about that.
The whole question of him being a liberal versus conservative, I mean, you mentioned that Simon is certainly a social liberal. The legalization of drugs, which is a story theme that was very prevalent in season three, obviously very much a libertarian type position, but I'm sure there's some people on the far left and far right who certainly would agree with that kind of change in drug policy. And also, you mentioned before a couple moments ago about Poot, the corner dealer, saying to the cops how things never change, things are always the same. He's actually one of the few bright spots in the series, because you see him at the very end. There's a couple of minutes where one of the other characters, a very tragic figure named Quan, walks into a Foot Locker shoe store, and he sees Poot, and Poot was this guy who used to sling drugs in the corner. Now he's got a regular job, and he asks him about it, and he's like, you know, it just got old. It got old, and here I am, and I've given up that way of life.
Yeah, and it's weird that we've sort of been acclimatized to seeing that as a triumphant moment, because after all, you know, this kid, he has no real education. He has very few prospects out of what he's doing now. He's working at a Foot Locker, you know. He's working at a minimum wage job that he'll probably keep for, you know, God knows how long. And yet we interpret that as a victory. We're like, it's so great that at least he's not just going to get shot on the corner for nothing, you know, over some drug deal. that's what we've been trained by the show to look at as a triumph, you know, that at least he was smart enough to get out of the drug game, which will just end in him being in jail or, you know, dead. So, you know, there's not a lot of shows that would give us seeing someone working at a minimum wage shoe clerk job as being a victory, but, you know, that's certainly the way it felt when I saw it, you know, on The Wire. When I saw Poot's little cameo as at the shoe store, I was like, oh, good for him.
Well, there's also another minor victory where Bubbles, who's he's a heroin junkie in the first few years of the show. He's basically a street informant for the police. And eventually he manages to move into his sister's basement. He gets an HIV test and it comes back negative, and there's this big sigh of relief for him. And it's a very minor victory, but in the sense of the show.
The scale of the show, his is probably the biggest redemption that we ever see. You know, the one glimpse of the fact that, you know, even as bad as things can be for you, and, you know, certainly he as a character experienced some of the worst tragedies and most terrible events of the show happened to him, that there's a possibility of redemption for him, I think certainly spells out the idea that Simon and Burns believe that there's at least some level of personal redemption possible. And as they have many of their characters, Bubbles was based on a real person. The person on whom he is based is still alive and still living in Baltimore, and recently got married to another woman who had gone through a very similar situation, and Simon and Burns were both in their wedding. And, you know, talked about how these two gave them hope that the sort of fictional redemption they portrayed in the show is really possible in life as well.
So we talked after season three, and in the last two seasons of the show, The Wire, the three major topics that have really been tackled are the education system, the political system in terms of city government, and also the media. And I want to start by talking about politics and season four and five. We're introduced to a character named Tommy Carchetti, who is a city councilman who winds up running against incumbent Mayor Clarence Royce. And certainly faced with a number of obstacles, the first and foremost that he's a white city councilman in a majority black city, and that fact is hammered time and time again by people who are running his campaign. And the show does an incredible job of chronicling the mayoral race in the city. You see the marshaling of support. You see Carchetti trying to enlist allies. You see him begging on the phone hour after hour for campaign donations. His consultants lock him in his office and say, okay, you're not leaving until you get $50,000 or $100,000. And you also see Clarence Royce portrayed through the show. You see him as just very corrupt individual. So we're encouraged to root for Carchetti, and we feel this sense of triumph when he actually wins. And then slowly, after the initial wave of enthusiasm, after you see some tangible change for the better, you see him slide down. It just becomes a political hack, just like his predecessor. What were your thoughts about the portrayal of the campaign, Tommy Carchetti in general?
Well, you know, I think it's really an amazing piece of work, you know, just the arc that Tommy Carchetti's character takes, and just as you mentioned, the real day-to-day dirt of running a political campaign, of having to raise funds and constantly, and I don't even know if I would agree that Carchetti ultimately is reduced to a political hack the way that Royce is, because Royce always seems a bit more corrupt than Carchetti is ever portrayed as being, but he certainly is absolutely denatured by compromise. He has to make so many compromises in order to get what he wants politically that by the end, he's really not doing any more good for Baltimore than his predecessor was. And incidentally, Carchetti also based on a real person, based on Mark Nomali, who, like Carchetti, started out as the mayor of Baltimore. Everybody predicted he would lose because he was white, and Baltimore had not had a white mayor in ages, and went on to become Democratic governor of Maryland. So, you know, once again, Simon and Burns were drawing on real life for that character. But, you know, amongst my friends who have watched the show, some of the most vituperative criticism has been leveled at Carchetti because he just starts out as this hopeful character. And really, in fact, he starts out somewhat cynical. He's a bit of a womanizer. But he eventually comes around to this belief that he can do a lot for the city and, you know, brings you these hopeful moments that there's going to be a new day dawning in Baltimore, as everyone puts it at the end of the fourth season. But, of course, you know, by the time it comes around, through all these little compromises he has to make of having to keep every pressure group happy, of not being able to hire and fire who he wants because it's going to displease some lobbying group or another, of wanting to become governor and so having to appeal to the white voters throughout the state, but also wanting to do right by his city, which means doing right by the black voters of Baltimore, which are often incompatible tendencies, he just becomes so compromised at the end that we are seeing him the way that we see almost all the other political figures in the city, you know, as just sort of this guy who is willing to do whatever it takes to get where he wants. And it's just really masterfully done, because they never come right out and have this moment where Carchetti does something monstrous, you know, where he just is clearly shown to be a villain. You know, I think that's one of the greatest things about The Wire, is that almost everyone is portrayed very deeply. You know, they're very three-dimensional characters. Almost no one is pure evil or pure good. You know, they're all people who make various decisions in their lives that they have to make in order to get by. And so there's never this moment where Carchetti is shown as just being an absolute villain. And yet at the end, the way that we see him is completely opposite of the way that we think of him by the end of the fourth season. We think of him as this hackish political figure who's sold out everything he came into office believing in order to become governor.
Well, the main problem with his political performance is his ambition to become governor. And it seems that about 6 months after he becomes mayor of Baltimore, he's already looking at becoming governor of Maryland. And that forces a number of things to happen. And he's got this chief of staff named Michael Steindorf. He shows up in season five after Carchetti's already in office. And he's kind of the devil on Carchetti's shoulder, always having him look ahead. And meanwhile, you also have the presence of his political consultant, his campaign consultant, Norman Woolson, who is a major figure in season four. He's also in season five basically around to give him the truth that he doesn't want to hear. Carchetti's running in this majority black city, so he's got black consultants. And even though the consultants, they joke with him, they say they never would vote for him because they never vote for a white candidate. Hey, he's signing the checks, so they're out there to get him elected. And I thought Norman was just an incredible character, and I thought the contrast there was fascinating to see.
Yeah, absolutely. Norman's a great character, and, you know, Steindorf, in his way, is a good character, too, because he's so pragmatic. You know, he's never shown as having any qualms about what he's saying. All he does is focus on what he was hired to do, and that is to get Carchetti into the governor's office. And so he never has these sort of jokey emotional moments that Norman has with Carchetti, because he doesn't care. He's just like, well, I'm going to tell you what you have to do to become governor, and that's all there is to it. And so he comes across as very bloodless, and yet, you know, he's the kind of person that every big politician has on staff. You know, this sort of calculating figure who says, look, you know, whatever you decide to do, you tell me what it is, and I'll tell you whether it's a politically expedient move. And of course, he comes across as a villain, but he's the sort of person who's hugely in demand in politics. You know, he's the guy who gets you elected and keeps you from making any mistakes, you know, as I'm sure he would put it, but, you know, in any kind of ethical stance that will alienate your voters. The tension between those two is palpable, and it really makes for some good drama in season five.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and I'm talking today to Leonard Pierce, and Leonard is back on the show once again to talk about HBO's landmark crime drama, The Wire. And The Wire recently wrapped up its fifth season on HBO, certainly viewed critically as one of the greatest shows in television history for its depiction of all sorts of societal themes and political themes, from politics to education to the media. We're going to talk a little bit about education, which is certainly a highlight of season four. Season four starts out with us following a group of four kids who are entering, I think it's eighth grade, and the kids are Michael, Daquan, who they call Dookie, Randy, and also Naaman. And these are all bright kids, none of them, except for one of them, Randy, who has a foster mom. None of the rest of them really have anything remotely resembling responsible guardians. During The Wire's first 3 years, we followed a number of kids who, by the time we saw them, they're already caught up in the Baltimore drug trade. We already saw them on the corners. But in seasons four and five, you follow these kids before they're involved with drugs at all. And we see that they're all bright kids. If they're growing up in some kind of normal suburban environment with a lot of support, they definitely go on to college. But here, you see them one by one, with the exception of one of them, Naaman. They all kind of fall prey to streets. And it's gut-wrenching at times to watch this go on. You know, you mentioned before about the political slant that David Simon, the creator of the show, is a social liberal. What did you think about the political slant regarding his views on education?
I think that's somewhat of a difficult question. And really, in that regard, you might want to consider the impact of Simon's co-creator, Ed Burns, on the show, because most of the educational material came from him. He was an ex-Baltimore homicide detective who became a teacher in the Baltimore school system, much like Przybylowski, the character on the show. So he's really the one, at least according to Simon, who is responsible for the educational material. He has firsthand experience of it, and almost all of the material he wrote that was written in the show about how dysfunctional the educational system in Baltimore and in most of our big cities is came from Ed Burns. Burns is apparently a bit more of a conservative than Simon is. You know, they're both fairly liberal, but Burns is said to be a tad more on the conservative side, you know, I guess the centrist side, you might say, than Simon is. But it is often difficult to tell, you know, their exact attitude. They clearly think that the system is broken, but they aren't especially clear on how they think it should be fixed. You know, they're huge critics of the No Child Left Behind system. They, you know, are many times in the fourth season we're shown scenes where kids are not really learning anything at all. They're merely being prepared to take standardized tests, which, you know, both of them seem to agree is poisonous to the educational system. But, you know, we also get the sense that they don't entirely believe that just pumping money into the system is going to help. I believe you mentioned a scene where they come across unused computers and equipment sitting in the basement that nobody has ever bothered to keep track of. And there's also when there are infusions of cash or resources from universities trying to do research into the way that the educational system functions, they often meet with resistance from the members of the school board. The teachers and the administrators of the school are often the ones who combat that because, you know, they believe that it's going to disrupt a system that even if they don't entirely support, they've at least learned how to navigate. So they don't resist the idea, you know, the traditional liberal idea that our schools need a lot more money and a lot more support. But I also think that they believe that any system, whether it's liberal or conservative, tends to fall into its own pattern of operation, and without really dedicated people there to find out whether it works or whether it doesn't, it's just going to become, you know, a self-sustaining system that's its only point isn't to do what it's supposed to do, but rather just to keep itself alive. And I think that we see that in some of the scenes in season four, where Bunny Colvin, who is an ex-cop who's become sort of an educational consultant, hooked up with a college professor who's trying to do research into the creation of these sort of street thugs and how the educational system might be failing them. And they meet a lot of resistance from the school teachers themselves, you know, who presumably, you know, they're teachers union people. They're probably on the liberal side, and yet they're very resistant to this idea to approach the system innovatively because it'll disrupt what they've learned how to use. And so I think that they have this attitude that can't really be easily contained within an idea of liberalism or conservatism. They just sort of believe that institutions will become dysfunctional if a close eye is not kept on them and if there are not people there to ask questions about how they function. And I think that you see that from both the liberal and conservative side in a lot of the school scenes.
So we're following these four kids. Like I mentioned, you have Michael, you have Daquan, Randy, and Naaman. And Naaman, actually, out of the four of them, his household has by far the most money, at least, because his father is a character named Weebay. And Weebay was a former dealer. He is now in jail for life. But because of his connections, his family has been receiving payments because he's a good soldier and keeping quiet in jail and not running anyone else out. So out of all of them, Naaman has the best clothes. Look at Naaman's place where he and his mom are living. It's very well furnished. And his mom is possibly the worst television mom in history. She calls him a failure when he's trying to go to school. What are you going to go to school for? What are you going to learn in school? She's basically pushing him to be a soldier, just like his father.
That's a practical lesson that she learned. You know, her lifestyle is sustained by having hooked up with a guy whose primary skill was being a killer. You know, so she doesn't see any benefit to sending her kid to school to become an academic, you know, or an educated kid, because that's not where her money came from. Why should she want that to happen to her son? She thinks it's weak when he wants to do things like that. She thinks it's a sign of weakness. And in that environment, it's almost difficult to say that she's wrong, because if Naaman were to stay in the criminal environment, which she has no reason to believe that that he can ever get out, then, you know, I mean, it's implied over and over again with Dookie that he's not cut out for the drug trade. When Michael becomes a corner boy and starts running his own drug corner, he tries to put Duquan in a position of authority, like running his crew, and the other kids disrespect Duquan because they think he's weak. You know, he's playful and sort of bright, and he doesn't really have a tough personality. So the other kids in the corner crew, they make fun of it. They don't respect him. They won't look up to his authority. And so eventually he gets cut loose and becomes a sort of drifter and, you know, sets off one of the most tragic character arcs in the whole show. Whereas Naaman, who's got the exact same problem, you know, it's emphasized over and over again that no matter how tough he tries to act, and, you know, the fact that his parents are these sort of stone cold, you know, his mother's a dragon lady, his father's a stone cold killer, you know, he doesn't have that in him. He fronts like he's a real tough guy, but when he's really in conflict, you know, again, kids don't respect him. They know he's not really hard. He's not really tough. And yet he takes exactly the opposite arc. You know, he's one of the few kids who gets out of it. You know, it's nice, I think, from a dramatic standpoint, that they show us two characters who have very similar situations. They're both bright, sensitive kids, and there's this pressure on them to become tough and hard, and both of them don't really have it in them. And one of them ends up in a miserable situation because of it, and one ends up very successful because of it. And it's all because of the circumstances surrounding, you know, and the people who are trying to help them out.
And there's a very sad conversation in season 5 between Dookie and a guy named Cuddy, who is a former drug dealer who, once he got released from jail, he kind of set himself straight. He now runs a boxing gym in the inner city. And because Dookie, like you mentioned, he knows that he's not getting respect. He knows he's not tough enough. He can't really hang on the streets. And he goes there for boxing lessons. And Cuddy can see immediately that he's just not cut out to be a fighter. It's just something in him. And he says, you know, even if you do become a fighter, at least learn the skills, even if you do carry a gun, people are still going to challenge you. People are still going to step to you because you just don't have that in you. But he tells Dookie, the whole world's not like inner city Baltimore. I mean, there's many, many parts of the world out there where your brains do get you ahead. And Dookie asks him, hey, well, how do I get to those places? And Cuddy just doesn't have an answer for him, and he wanders off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one of the central tragedies of the show, is that it shows us time and time again the reason that these inner-city kids develop the sort of attitudes and behaviors and skills that they develop, which are almost vitally necessary for them to survive in the environment that they're in. But once they're taken out of that environment, those very skills and attitudes and behaviors are what label them as dysfunctional or sociopathic or turn them into failures in the greater world. And one of the central problems that the show confronts us with is, how are we going to get them out of that environment? How are we going to teach them that the whole world isn't like that when their entire upbringing is to think, well, in order to make it, I need to sling drugs, I need to have game, you know, I need to be tough, I need to never show the kind of weakness that people associate with being intellectual or being sensitive. How are we going to get them to develop skills that will help them function in the outside world if they're going to spend their entire lives in this brutal system in which they do need to develop these sort of psychopathic sort of skills?
There's a great scene in season 4 where Naaman and three of the other kids in his special class, he's separated in special class with other what they call corner kids, because those are kids who have huge discipline problems and they have to learn how to behave before they attend regular classrooms. They have this sort of contest that Naaman and his team wins. And as a prize, Bunny Colvin, who's the ex-cop, takes the four kids out to a very nice restaurant in downtown Baltimore. And you can see that the four kids there, they're all dressed up in their best clothes. They're very excited on their way to the restaurant. And throughout the evening, they become just more and more intimidated by feeling that they don't belong, feeling that they just don't understand how to operate in that society. And by the very end, they're just very disheartened by the whole experience.
They're so awkward and they feel so out of place in that world that they sort of revert back into their bad behavior patterns. And that's something that we see most explicitly in that scene, but there are echoes of it all throughout the show. Even in the very first season, we see D'Angelo Barksdale, you know, Avon Barksdale, the drug kingpin's nephew, and, you know, a fairly high-ranking player in the drug game at the time. He takes his girlfriend to a, not even a really fancy restaurant, just a, you know, a normal, nice restaurant in a white part of town, and he's doing well as a drug dealer, so he's got plenty of money, but he feels so out of place there. You know, he thinks that everyone is watching them. He feels like everyone is keenly attuned to what they're doing and is expecting them to do something bad. And his girlfriend tries to tell him, well, don't worry, you know, your money spends as well as theirs. That's all that anyone cares about. but he feels so ill at ease there because he's just not attuned to that sort of environment. And we also see it in season three where Stringer Bell, who's one of the big drug kingpins, you know, his goal is to go legitimate and become a straight businessman. And when he becomes involved in these real estate deals, he gets swindled because the, you know, the straight operators in the real estate world, they know he's a sucker. They don't know he doesn't really know how the business works, so they fleece him whenever they get a chance. And we see an echo of that in season five where Marlowe, who's the new drug kingpin, also meets with some downtown real estate players and decides he's going to wear a suit and get involved in the legitimate world to funnel all his drug profits into some regular enterprise. And yet when he returns home to the ghetto, he hears all the people on the corner talking about Omar, who's this sort of renegade stick-up guy who's played a major part in the role, and how tough he was and how he's this legendary fighter. And then they see Marlowe dressed up in his suit, you know, and coming back from this business meeting. And Omar had previously in the show been questioning Marlowe's toughness and his streetworthiness, and so everyone makes fun of him. And he ends up, you know, confronting them and beating them in a fight and chasing them off of the corner, but he looks so uncomfortable. He looks like a guy who just can't escape where he came from, and now he's torn between these worlds. You know, he's trying to retain his street credibility, but he's wearing the suit and trying to mix with businessmen who are almost certainly going to rip him off the way that they did Stringer Bell. And, you know, you see echoes of that all throughout the show. There's a great scene when Odie, another one of the street thugs, leaves Baltimore to do a drug run into Philadelphia, and he's shocked when the radio stations are different. He's never been out of Baltimore, so he doesn't understand that each city has its own radio stations and that they're different from place to place. And just when people are raised in these completely closed environments, it's really shocking when they're taken out of it and they just don't have the skills to adapt it. And, you know, while that scene in the restaurant with Bunny and the street kids, it's the most explicit example of that, it's certainly not the only one. There are some great moments in season five where, and even in season four, but especially season five, which focuses pretty heavily on Marlowe, where it's clear that he just doesn't know how the real world works. You know, he's so saturated in the way of the streets. And at one point, Proposition Joe, who's sort of this, you know, he's one of the brighter drug kingpins. You know, he knows how things operate in the outside world, and he's a bit of a hustler and a smoothie. He's not one of these violent street thugs who came up just through brutality. He's shown more of, as sort of a canny businessman. And he's the one who hooks Marlowe up with good drug trade from the Greeks, who are shown frequently as these nefarious villains who bring drugs into the United States. And he also helps Marlowe to become somewhat legitimate. He gets him an offshore bank account to launder his drug money. And Marlowe doesn't understand how banks work. He actually has to fly to the Cayman Islands to see his money because he doesn't believe it's really there. And that's, you know, how completely out of touch he is with the way that the world works, is that, you know, he can't even be convinced that his money is really in a bank. He, you know, if he can't see it, he doesn't believe it even exists.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and you're listening to Under Surveillance on WLEW. And returning as my guest once again is freelance writer and pop culture critic Leonard Pierce. And we're talking about HBO's landmark crime drama, The Wire. We did a show a couple of years ago after season three where we talked about a number of social and political themes running through the show. The Wire just recently finished up about a month ago, its fifth and final season. And we've been talking about creator David Simon and also co-creator Ed Burns, their views on societal institutions ranging from the educational system to city government. I want to also talk now about the media. And that's certainly something that was heavily emphasized in season five. We were given a look at the Baltimore Sun as a reflection of the problems facing print media, certainly very much on the decline. You see a lot of cutbacks in the Baltimore Sun, much like the ones that major newspapers are making. They're closing their foreign bureaus. They're laying off people left and right. There's a thread going through season five, a major thread that involves a manufactured story. And I want to get to that in a little bit. But first of all, Leonard, where do you see the media heading with regards to print versus the internet?
You know, I actually thought that the media, the Baltimore Sun plotline in season five was really not especially successful. It was one of the big weak points of the series for me. Simon, who used to be a Baltimore Sun reporter, was often accused of sort of carrying out old personal grudges through the characters. And I don't really know enough about his past in the newspaper business to make a judgment on whether I think that's correct or not. But I do think that one of its biggest weaknesses as a storyline is that it strays away from what I was talking about earlier, that the show is really masterful at never showing anybody as a complete hero or a complete villain. You know, everybody is shown to have very complex personalities, and that even the really bad guys have some redeeming feature, and even the really good guys have self-destructive tendencies or whatever. Whereas in the newspaper plot, that didn't really come through for me. The managing editor and the publisher of the paper were both shown as these cartoonishly bad people. You know, they constantly made the wrong decision. They were never shown as being thoughtful about anything. They were just completely focused on the bottom line and really oblivious sort of stereotypes of incompetent managers. Whereas the old reporters, you know, and the city editor, they were shown as being, you know, sort of saintly and just representing all the purity of what newspapers used to be. So I thought that dramatically it was a bit of a letdown, but I do think it brings up a lot of really good points about how the newspaper business operates today. You know, they certainly showed up how online publications and, you know, media oversaturation in the 24-hour news cycle are really badly affecting the daily newspaper business. They brought up a lot of good points about how there can't be really good reportage unless you're willing to invest in good people who take the time to develop their contacts and, you know, who take the time to research their stories properly. And certainly one of the things he brings up a lot, which is, you know, every major newspaper has encountered this in recent years, is this sort of Pulitzer-chasing, you know, award-focused publicity-mongering reporting that isn't often well fact-checked. And that's another issue that goes beyond partisanship. It's happened both on the left and the right. You know, if you look at some liberal reporters in the past, like the woman from the Washington Post who invented a 10-year-old drug addict, you know, in order to tell a story about how inner cities are plagued with drugs. And then, of course, you look at somebody like Judith Miller for the New York Times, who did these extremely uncritical reports that were basically handed to her by the government about the buildup of arms in Iraq. I think it's a very nonpartisan issue in that regard, that papers are so determined to chase prize-winning journalism or sort of shocking, you know, we get the story first journalism that will get them more readers and thus pick up their advertisers, that they aren't taking the time to really research the stories the way that they should. I think that there are obviously a huge number of issues that they touched on in the newspaper arc that are legitimate issues and I think, you know, very well addressed. I just sort of wish it had been followed in a more dramatically satisfying way.
And not only do you have the issue, certainly, with the accuracy of newspaper stories, but there have been a number of books recently that have come out where the stories have been manufactured or the backgrounds of the authors in question have certainly been misrepresented. Before, earlier in the show, we were talking about, does Simon and Burns, do we see society as sliding? So, you know, that same question with regards to the media, in terms of just the rate of manufactured stories, in terms of the resources that are applied, you know, I would tend to think that we probably do have, in some instances, more oversight today than we did 50 years ago, 60 years ago, when, you know, you make a mistake, you screw up today, and boom, you've got 10 people writing about it and doing web research and pointing it out online.
There's good arguments to be made on both sides of that issue. I mean, obviously, to me, if you tell me that things are much better today in terms of accuracy in media, I don't think that that's necessarily false because, yeah, there's an awful lot of oversight today. And especially, I mean, if you look at the newspapers of the, you know, around the turn of the century all the way up until the 20s and 30s, they were terrible. I mean, often newspapers, you know, the yellow journalists would just invent stories completely without any regard to accuracy at all, just in an attempt to outdo the other dailies. So it's very hard for me to accept the idea that way back in the day when there were, you know, when a typical city had five or six daily newspapers instead of just one, that things were necessarily better in terms of reporting. But on the other hand, one of the problems with media oversaturation, which is what we have now, you know, while there's no longer many daily newspapers, there's a million different blogs, there's a million TV networks, is that no one really cares anymore. You know, someone can be exposed as a fraud in a journalistic sense, and it's not really a big deal. They're forgotten, you know, and people are so cynical now because of all these stories. You know, I write for political blogs from time to time, and you know, it shocks me how often, for instance, conservative blogs will constantly denigrate any story that appears in the New York Times, because, you know, and they'll bring up some New York Times reporter who committed journalistic fraud, except when the New York Times reports something that is favorable to them, in which case they, you know, cite the New York Times as a bastion of journalism and the paper of record and so forth. So I think people have become so cynical about the news that and the newspaper business that, you know, they really don't even take the time to consider the fact that there's this standard of journalism to which they should be aspiring, that they're just looking for confirmation one way or another of their ideological viewpoint. So it's both better and worse today than it was in the past. I think that if I had to point to one thing that's absolutely worse, it's that because there's so much competition, especially from the internet and from television, that they're focused so intently on the bottom line that they can't afford to hire the best reporters anymore. They can't keep foreign bureaus open, and so all of their reports from overseas are coming from wire services. You know, I think the overall quality of journalism is on the decline, if for no other reason than it's not a situation like it was in the 50s through the 70s, where big newspapers could afford to hire the best reporters and afford to hire their own people overseas and afford to pay their people really good salaries so that they could stay on staff for a long time and take the time to develop these contacts, which is mentioned in season 5 a lot. With the departure of their crime reporter, they lose all of his contacts, all these people that he's taken years and years to develop. And without those contacts, they know nothing. You know, they're constantly getting surprised by stories because those contacts are no longer there for them. So I think in some ways it's obviously a lot better today, but I think in other ways it's a lot worse.
Yeah, I just saw an article recently about media critics. I know you provide film criticism for Nerve.com, correct? Screen Grab?
Mm-hmm.
There was an article talking about how those positions are being cut back at a lot of major media outlets.
Oh, yeah, film critics are absolutely on the way out. There's many daily newspapers now who don't have their own film critic.
And you mentioned that in terms of stories overseas, they'll just get copy off the wire as opposed to having their own for correspondence. So what you have happen is it's almost like the One World newspaper, right? The Associated Press, basically One Voice or whoever that might be.
Right, which I think is a bad thing in general. I mean, if you're talking about music or film criticism or something, it used to be that you would get a local flavor, you know, go someplace, you could say, oh, well, what does their film critic think about this movie? And, you know, you would get to know particular critical scenes, like the New York critical scene was very different than the Chicago critical scene. But nowadays, even with independent papers, you know, like alternative weeklies, so many of them have been bought up recently by the Village Voice. Voice Media, or New Times Media, I think it's called now, have bought up tons of independent weekly newspapers in big cities. And now they're doing the same things that the national newspapers are doing, which is syndicating their content. So, you know, now, wherever you go, even if you pick up the local indie newspaper, you're still going to find the same film critics or the same music critics. And when you're seeing that with criticism, it's one thing. I think it sort of degrades the culture in a certain sense. But when you're seeing it with reporting, I think it's much more damaging, because if you've only got one or two reporters who are working on major news stories that are going to be syndicated all throughout the country, then I think that can be very damaging, because if they're wrong and there's no other reporters covering that story, no one will ever know what's really going on.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and you're listening to Under Surveillance on WLEW. And I've been talking with Leonard Pierce about all sorts of political and social themes relating to HBO's crime drama The Wire, which recently finished up its fifth and final season. Leonard, do you think The Wire will have any tangible lasting effect on the way that people approach television or view societal ills?
More the former than the latter. Sadly, I think that it's going to have almost no effect whatsoever on the way that people view social ills. Its viewership was just not enough. It always had a limited viewership, and for better or for worse, a lot of its viewership was African-American. You know, people in the inner cities, they idolized the show. In fact, one of the things that I think is interesting is that here in San Antonio, where I'm living now, if you go into a Walmart or a Target, their DVD section has what's called an African-American section. You know, it's films and television shows directed at a black audience. And that's where you find The Wire. You don't find it under TV shows. You find it in the so-called black section. And I think that's really fascinating, you know, and maybe even kind of bad, you know, because that's the section that white people are never going to look at, right? You know, they're going to look at it and say, yeah, that's the black shows. I don't need to watch that.
So
maybe the people who need to watch it the most are the ones who are not going to be watching it. But it always had a small audience. In its third season, it was almost canceled, and something almost completely unprecedented took place, which is that a bunch of TV critics put together a petition to keep it on the air, and critics are not supposed to do that. They're supposed to sort of maintain a, you know, neutrality, and of course they can always advocate for some show or another to stay on the air in their column, but they're really not supposed to petition the producers or the networks or anything. But The Wire was so beloved by TV critics that they did this petition and sort of kept it alive for a bit, but it never had any kind of big audience, even if its fifth season was its biggest season in terms of ratings, and even then it was very small. So I just don't think enough people watched it to make a difference in the way anybody perceives social policy. You mentioned earlier that Barack Obama mentioned it was his favorite show, and I think that probably the reaction to that was more bewilderment than anything else. I imagine most people who heard him say that didn't know what he was talking about. In terms of how people make television, though, I think it may make a difference. If nothing else, it showed that it's possible to make a show that's very critically successful and very groundbreaking with a limited series run. Because, you know, when it was technically still canceled. The fifth season was the end, but Simon Burns had only wanted five seasons to begin with. So HBO just said, well, okay, we're going to cancel the show, but we'll give you a fifth season. So there's a sort of trope in American television that you just keep a show going forever as long as the ratings are good. In British television, it's not really like that. In European television, shows are often constructed from the beginning to have a limited series run to tell a specific story, and when that story is over, the show ends. And American television, generally outside of miniseries, is not constructed that way. And I'm hoping that, you know, if nothing else, the show's sophistication, the way that it approached its characters, because one of the unique things about it is that it didn't really have main characters. You know, you had a lot of characters who recurred over and over again, but there was no one real star of the show. You know, even the central character of the show, which arguably would be the cop McNulty, we haven't even talked about him today. You know,
I noticed that.
You can talk about the show endlessly and never mention lots of the biggest characters. You know, I think that hopefully that ensemble approach, the way that it was constructed to have a beginning, a middle, and an end, I think that may affect the way that some shows are produced in the future, that people can point to The Wire and say, well, you know, that show worked, so why don't you give me a chance to do a show like that? And maybe it'll sort of change that, keep it running until it dies, way of producing shows that we have right now. But I cannot ever recall a show which so completely set out to tell a story about institutional dysfunction. Critics have said it from the beginning of the show that the show isn't really about people, it's about institutions, it's about the city of Baltimore, it's about a typical American city and what works in it and what doesn't. And I really cannot remember a show that took that approach.
Yeah, and there are lots of films that tackle these sorts of subjects, but never a weekly television show. And, you know, for a film, you can put up with a couple of hours of tragedy, perhaps, and gut-wrenching scenes, and then, well, the movie's over. Usually there's some sort of positive note you're left with, and you go out into the streets. And but here with The Wire, it's just this hammering message week after week, year after year.
You get those moments of redemption, but they're so few and far between, you know, and it's absolutely a show that rewards very close attention, which, you know, as many people have commented, makes it really more like a novel than a television show. And that's not something that a lot of people have patience for. So,
one final note. David Simon, I believe, is working on a show called Generation Kill, and that apparently is about the war in Iraq.
That's correct. And Ed Burns is collaborating with him again on that as well, because Burns, in addition to being a Baltimore cop and an ex-school teacher, he's also a military veteran. He's a Vietnam War veteran, so he's once again going to be sort of the practical end of Simon's creative endeavors. I'm really looking forward to the show. I mean, I'm sure that he's not going to stray very far from his institutional critique and certainly the way he handled characters. And that's something that doesn't get talked about much in The Wire. A friend of mine, who's also a film critic, says that he thinks the problem with a lot of criticism of The Wire is that it makes it sound like homework. You know, it makes it sound like it's not any fun, that, you know, you're learning all these lessons about institutional dysfunction and, you know, it has all these depressing, heart-wrenching character arcs, But what doesn't get talked about enough is the fact that it's an incredibly entertaining show as well. It's very funny. You know, some of the scenes of workplace comedy, sort of, and the way that the cops tell jokes, these sort of morbid jokes to each other, and, you know, some of the hilarious dialogue that the gang members have with each other are very funny. I mean, the characters in it are just so compelling. I mean, you could talk for hours and hours about some of the great characters on The Wire. So it really isn't like homework at all. I mean, I feel like even now, today, we've talked so much about it and made it seem like homework, and it really isn't. You know, it's really an amazingly entertaining show. You know, I'm even more looking forward to that approach being used to the Iraq War drama that he's making, Generation Kill, because I'm sure he'll take the same tactic. And so, you know, I would imagine that we're going to get some more sort of critiques of the institutional policies of government and of the military, but we're also going to get them framed, you know, around very fascinating characters.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and you've been listening to Under Surveillance on WLUW, and I've been joined for the past hour by Leonard Pierce, who's a freelance writer and pop culture critic. Leonard is a film critic for Nerve.com, and he always has a number of writing projects in progress. You can find out more information at his website at www.ludikid.com. That's ludickid.com. Anything in particular that we should know about, Leonard?
We'll be in Seattle, Washington next week giving a presentation at the Experience Music Project. I also have a number of freelance projects I'm working on at the moment, and there should be in June a new issue of The Hi Hat out. I've written about The Wire extensively in The Hi Hat before, so if you go to thehihat.com, you can find pieces that I've written about it and also pieces that other Hi Hat writers have written about it. It's naturally been one of our favorite shows for the last 5 years. So,
Leonard, thank you very much for coming on the show. It's always a pleasure to have you back on.
Thank you, Kevin.
For Leonard Pierce, my name is Kevin Fulham, and you've been listening to Under Surveillance on WLUW. And for more information or to listen to archived shows, visit www.undersurveillance.org. That's www.undersurveillance.org.